conflict of passionate altercation and angry reproaches. A blow was imprudently given, a sword was hastily drawn, and the first blood that was spilt in this accidental quarrel became the signal of a long and destructive war. In the midst of noise and brutal intemperance, Lupicinus was informed by a secret messenger that many of his soldiers were slain and despoiled of their arms, and as he was already inflamed by wine and oppressed by sleep, he issued a rash command that their death should be revenged by the massacre of the guards of Fritigern and Alavivus. The clamorous shouts and dying groans apprised Fritigern of his extreme danger, and as he possessed the calm and intrepid spirit of a hero, he saw that he was lost if he allowed a moment of deliberation to the man who had so deeply injured him. "A trifling dispute," said the Gothic leader, with a firm but gentle tone of voice, "appears to have arisen between the two nations, but it may be productive of the most dangerous consequences unless the tumult is immediately pacified by the assurance of our safety and the authority of our presence." At these words, Fritigern and his companions drew their swords, opened their passage through the unresisting crowd which filled the palace, the streets, and the gates of Marcianopolis, and mounting their horses, hastily vanished from the eyes of the astonished Romans. The generals of the Goths were saluted by the fierce and joyful acclamations of the camp. War was instantly resolved, and the resolution was executed without delay. The banners of the nation were displayed according to the custom of their ancestors, and the air resounded with the harsh and mournful music of the barbarian trumpet. The weak and guilty Lupicinus, who had dared to provoke, who had neglected to destroy, and who was still presumed to despise his formidable enemy, marched against the Goths at the head of such a military force as could be collected on this sudden emergency. The barbarians expected his approach about 9 miles from Marcianopolis, and on this occasion the talents of the general were found to be of more prevailing efficacy than the weapons and discipline of the troops. The valor of the Goths was so ably directed by the genius of Fritigern that they broke, by a close and vigorous attack, the ranks of the Roman legions. Lupicinus left his arms and standards, his tribunes and his bravest soldiers on the field of battle, and their useless courage served only to protect the ignominious flight of their leader. That successful day put an end to the distress of the barbarians and the security of the Romans. From that day, the Goths, renouncing the precarious condition of strangers and exiles, assumed the character of citizens and masters, claimed an absolute dominion over the possessors of land, and held in their own right the northern provinces of the empire, which are bounded by the Danube. Such are the words of the Gothic historian, who celebrates with rude eloquence the glory of his countrymen. But the dominion of the barbarians was exercised only for the purposes of rapine and destruction. As they had been deprived by the ministers of the emperor of the common benefits of nature and the fair intercourse of social life, they retaliated the injustice on the subjects of the empire, and the crimes of Lupicinus were expiated by the ruin of the peaceful husbandmen of Thrace, the conflagration of their villages, and the massacre or captivity of their innocent families. The report of the Gothic victory was soon diffused over the adjacent country, and while it filled the minds of the Romans with terror and dismay, their own hasty imprudence contributed to increase the forces of Fritigern and the calamities of the province. Some time before the great emigration, a numerous body of Goths under the command of Suerid and Coelius had been received into the protection and service of the empire. They were encamped under the walls of Hadrianople, but the ministers of Valens were anxious to remove them beyond the Hellespont, at a distance from the dangerous temptation which might so easily be communicated by the neighborhood and the success of their countrymen. the respectful submission with which they yielded to the order of their march might be considered as a proof of their fidelity, and their moderate request of a sufficient allowance of provisions and of a delay of only 2 days was expressed in the most dutiful terms. But the first magistrate of Hadrianople, incensed by some disorders which had been committed at his country house, refused this indulgence, and arming against them the inhabitants and manufacturers of a populous city, he urged with hostile threats their instant departure. The barbarians stood silent and amazed till they were exasperated by the insulting clamours and missile weapons of the populace. But when patience or contempt was fatigued, they crushed the undisciplined multitude, inflicted many a shameful wound on the backs of their flying enemies, and despoiled them of the splendid armour which they were unworthy to bear. The resemblance of their sufferings and their actions soon united this victorious detachment to the nation of the Visigoths. The troops of Curlius and Suerid expected the approach of the great Fritigern, ranged themselves under his standard, and signalized their ardour in the siege of Hadrianople. But the resistance of the garrison informed the barbarians that in the attack of regular fortifications the efforts of unskillful courage are seldom effectual. Their general acknowledged his error, raised the siege, declared that he was at peace with stone walls, and revenged his disappointment on the adjacent country. He accepted with pleasure the useful reinforcement of hardy workmen who labored in the gold mines of Thrace for the emolument and under the lash of an unfeeling master. And these new associates conducted the barbarians through the secret paths to the most sequestered places which had been chosen to secure the inhabitants, the cattle, and the magazines of corn. With the assistance of such guides, nothing could remain impervious or inaccessible. Resistance was fatal. Flight was impracticable. And the patient submission of helpless innocents seldom found mercy from the barbarian conqueror. In the course of these depredations, a great number of the children of the Goths, who had been sold into captivity, were restored to the embraces of their afflicted parents. But these tender interviews, which might have revived and cherished in their minds some sentiments of humanity, tended only to stimulate their native fierceness by the desire of revenge. They listened with eager attention to the complaints of their captive children who had suffered the most cruel indignities from the lustful or angry passions of their masters, and the same cruelties, the same indignities, were severely retaliated on the sons and daughters of the Romans. The imprudence of Valens and his ministers had introduced into the heart of the empire a nation of enemies, but the Visigoths might even yet have been reconciled by the manly confession of past errors and the sincere performance of former engagements. These healing and temperate measures seemed to concur with the timorous disposition of the sovereign of the East. But on this occasion alone, Valens was brave, and his unseasonable bravery was fatal to himself and to his subjects. He declared his intention of marching from Antioch to Constantinople to subdue this dangerous rebellion, and as he was not ignorant of the difficulties of the enterprise, he solicited the assistance of his nephew, the Emperor Gratian, who commanded all the forces of the West. The veteran troops were hastily recalled from the defense of Armenia. That important frontier was abandoned to the discretion of Sapor, and the immediate conduct of the Gothic War was entrusted during the absence of Valens to his lieutenants Trajan and Profuturus, two generals who indulged themselves in a very false and favorable opinion of their own abilities. On their arrival in Thrace, they were joined by Ricomer, Count of the domestics, and the auxiliaries of the West that marched under his banner were composed of the Gallic legions, reduced indeed by spirit of desertion to the vain appearances of strength and numbers. In a council of war which was influenced by pride rather than by reason, it was resolved to seek and to encounter the barbarians who lay encamped in the spacious and fertile meadows near the most northern of the six mouths of the Danube. Their camp was surrounded by the usual fortification of wagons, and the barbarians, secure within the vast circle of the enclosure, enjoyed the fruits of their valour and the spoils of the province. In the midst of riotous intemperance, the watchful Fritigern observed the motions and penetrated the designs of the Romans. He perceived that the numbers of the enemy were continually increasing, and as he understood their intention of attacking his rear as soon as the scarcity of forage should oblige him to remove his camp, he recalled to their standard his predatory detachments which covered the adjacent country. As soon as they descried the flaming beacons, they obeyed, with incredible speed, the signal of their leader. The camp was filled with the martial crowd of barbarians. Their impatient clamors demanded the battle, and their tumultuous zeal was approved and animated by the spirit of their chiefs. The evening was already far advanced, and the two armies prepared themselves for the approaching combat, which was deferred only till the dawn of day. While the trumpets sounded to arms, the undaunted courage of the Goths was confirmed by the mutual obligation of a solemn oath, and as they advanced to meet the enemy, the rude songs which celebrated the glory of their forefathers were mingled with their fierce and dissonant outcries, and opposed to the artificial harmony of the Roman shout. Some military skill was displayed by Fritigern to gain the advantage of a commanding eminence, but the bloody conflict which began and ended with the light was maintained on either side by the personal and obstinate efforts of strength, valour, and agility. The legions of Armenia supported their fame in arms, but they were oppressed by the irresistible weight of the hostile multitude. The left wing of the Romans was thrown into disorder, and the field was strewed with their mangled carcasses. This partial defeat was balanced, however, by partial success, and when the two armies, at a late hour of the evening, retreated to their respective camps, neither of them could claim the honors or the effects of a decisive victory. The real loss was more severely felt by the Romans, in proportion to the smallness of their numbers. But the Goths were so deeply confounded and dismayed by this vigorous and perhaps unexpected resistance that they remained 7 days within the circle of their fortifications. Such funeral rites, as the circumstances of time and place would admit, were piously discharged to some officers of distinguished rank, but the indiscriminate vulgar was left unburied on the plain. Their flesh was greedily devoured by the birds of prey, who in that age enjoyed very frequent and delicious feasts. And several years afterwards, the white and naked bones which covered the wide extent of the fields presented to the eyes of Ammianus a dreadful monument of the Battle of Salicis. The progress of the Goths had been checked by the doubtful event of that bloody day, and the imperial generals, whose army would have been consumed by the repetition of such a contest, embraced the more rational plan of destroying the barbarians by the wants and pressure of their own multitude. They prepared to confine the Visigoths in the narrow angle of land between the Danube, the desert of Scythia, and the mountains of Hemus, till their strength and spirit should be insensibly wasted by the inevitable operation of famine. The design was prosecuted with some conduct and success. The barbarians had almost exhausted their own magazines and the harvests of the country, and the diligence of Saturninus, the master general of the cavalry, was employed to improve the strength and to contract the extent of the Roman fortifications. His labors were interrupted by the alarming intelligence that new swarms of barbarians had passed the unguarded Danube, either to support the cause or to imitate the example of Fritigern. The just apprehension that he himself might be surrounded and overwhelmed by the arms of hostile and unknown nations compelled Saturninus to relinquish the siege of the Gothic camp, and the indignant Visigoths, breaking from their confinement, satiated their hunger and revenge by the repeated devastation of the fruitful country, which extends above 300 miles from the banks of the Danube to the straits of the Hellespont. The sagacious Fritigern had successfully appealed to the passions as well as to the interest of his barbarian allies, and the love of rapine and the hatred of Rome seconded or even prevented the eloquence of his ambassadors. He cemented a strict and useful alliance with the great body of his countrymen, who obeyed Alethius and Sephrax as the guardians of their infant king. The long animosity of rival tribes was suspended by the sense of their common interest. The independent part of the nation was associated under one standard, and the chiefs of the Ostrogoths appear to have yielded to the superior genius of the general of the Visigoths. He obtained the formidable aid of the Typhali, whose military renown was disgraced and polluted by the public infamy of their domestic manners. Every youth on his entrance into the world was united by the ties of honorable friendship and brutal love to some warrior of the tribe, nor could he hope to be released from this unnatural connection till he had approved his manhood by slaying in single combat a huge bear or a wild boar of the forest. But the most powerful auxiliaries of the Goths were drawn from the camp of those enemies who had expelled them from their native seats. The loose subordination and extensive possessions of the Huns and the Alani delayed the conquests and distracted the counsels of that victorious people. Several of the hordes were allured by the liberal promises of Fritigern, and the rapid cavalry of Scythia added weight and energy to the steady and strenuous efforts of the Gothic infantry. The Sarmatians, who could never forgive the successor of Valentinian, enjoyed and increased the general confusion, and a seasonable eruption of the Alemanni into the provinces of Gaul engaged the attention and diverted the forces of the Emperor of the West. One of the most dangerous inconveniences of the introduction of the barbarians into the army and the palace was sensibly felt in their correspondence with their hostile countrymen, to whom they imprudently, or maliciously, revealed the weakness of the Roman Empire. A soldier of the lifeguards of Gratian was of the nation of the Alemanni and of the tribe of the Lentienses, who dwelt beyond the Lake of Constance. Some domestic business obliged him to request a leave of absence. In a short visit to his family and friends, he was exposed to their curious inquiries, and the vanity of the loquacious soldier tempted him to display his intimate acquaintance with the secrets of the state and the designs of his master. The intelligence that Gratian was preparing to lead the military force of Gaul and of the West to the assistance of his uncle Valens pointed out to the restless spirit of the Alemanni the moment and the mode of a successful invasion. The enterprise of some light detachments who in the month of February passed the Rhine upon the ice was the prelude of a more important war. The boldest hopes of rapine, perhaps of conquest, outweighed the considerations of timid prudence or national faith. Every forest and every village poured forth a band of hardy adventurers, and the great army of the Alemanni, which on their approach was estimated at 40,000 men by the fears of the people, was afterwards magnified to the number of 70,000 by the vain and credulous flattery of the imperial court. The legions which had been ordered to march into Pannonia were immediately recalled or detained for the defense of Gaul. The military command was divided between Nanienus and Melobaudes, and the youthful emperor, though he respected the long experience and sober wisdom of the former, was much more inclined to admire and to follow the martial ardor of his colleague, who was allowed to unite the incompatible characters of Count of the Domestics and of King of the Franks. His rival, Priarius, King of the Alemanni, was guided, or rather impelled, by the same headstrong valor, And as their troops were animated by the spirit of their leaders, they met, they saw, they encountered each other near the town of Argentaria, or Colmar, in the plains of Alsace. The glory of the day was justly ascribed to the missile weapons and well-practiced evolutions of the Roman soldiers. The Alamanni, who long maintained their ground, were slaughtered with unrelenting fury. 5,000 only of the barbarians escaped to the woods and mountains, and the glorious death of their king on the field of battle saved him from the reproaches of the people, who are always disposed to accuse the justice or policy of an unsuccessful war. After this signal victory, which secured the peace of Gaul and asserted the honor of the Roman arms, the Emperor Gratian appeared to proceed without delay on his eastern expedition. But as he approached the confines of the Alamanni, he suddenly inclined to the left, surprised them by his unexpected passage of the Rhine, and boldly advanced into the heart of their country. The barbarians opposed to his progress the obstacles of nature and of courage, and still continued to retreat from one hill to another, till they were satisfied by repeated trials of the power and perseverance of their enemies. Their submission was accepted as a proof, not indeed of their sincere repentance, but of their actual distress, and a select number of their brave and robust youth was exacted from the faithless nation as the most substantial pledge of their future moderation. The subjects of the empire, who had so often experienced that the Alamanni could neither be subdued by arms nor restrained by treaties, might not promise themselves any solid or lasting tranquillity, but they discovered in the virtues of their young sovereign the prospect of a long and auspicious reign. When the legions climbed the mountains and scaled the fortifications of the barbarians, the valor of Gratian was distinguished in the foremost ranks, and the gilt and variegated armor of his guards was pierced and shattered by the blows which they had received in their constant attachment to the person of their sovereign. At the age of 19, the son of Valentinian seemed to possess the talents of peace and war, and his personal success against the Alamanni was interpreted as a sure presage of his Gothic triumphs. While Gratian deserved and enjoyed the applause of his subjects, the Emperor Valens, who at length had removed his court and army from Antioch, was received by the people of Constantinople as the author of the public calamity. Before he had reposed himself 10 days in the capital, he was urged by the licentious clamors of the Hippodrome to march against the barbarians, whom he had invited into his dominions. And the citizens, who were always brave at a distance from any real danger, declared with confidence that if they were supplied with arms, they alone would undertake to deliver the province from the ravages of an insulting foe. The vain reproaches of an ignorant multitude hastened the downfall of the Roman Empire. They provoked the desperate rashness of Valens, who did not find, either in his reputation or in his mind, any motives to support with firmness the public contempt. He was soon persuaded by the successful achievements of his lieutenants to despise the power of the Goths, who, by the diligence of Fritigern, were now collected in the neighbourhood of Hadrianople. The march of the Typhali had been intercepted by the valiant Frigeric. The king of those licentious barbarians was slain in battle, and the suppliant captives were sent into distant exile to cultivate the lands of Italy, which were assigned for their settlement in the vacant territories of Modena and Parma. The exploits of Sebastian, who was recently engaged in the service of Valens and promoted to the rank of Master General of the Infantry, were still more honourable to himself and useful to the Republic. He obtained the permission of selecting 300 soldiers from each of the legions, and this separate detachment soon acquired the spirit of discipline and the exercise of arms, which were almost forgotten under the reign of Valens. By the rigour and conduct of Sebastian, a large body of the Goths were surprised in their camp, and the immense spoil which was recovered from their hands filled the city of Hadrianople and the adjacent plain. The splendid narratives which the general transmitted of his own exploits alarmed the imperial court by the appearance of superior merit, and though he cautiously insisted on the difficulties of the Gothic war, his valour was praised, his advice was rejected, and Valens, who listened with pride and pleasure to the flattering suggestions of the eunuchs of the palace, was impatient to seize the glory of an easy and assured conquest. His army was strengthened by numerous reinforcement of veterans, and his march from Constantinople to Hadrianople was conducted with so much military skill that he prevented the activity of the barbarians, who designed to occupy the intermediate defiles and to intercept either the troops themselves or their convoys of provisions. The camp of Valens, which he pitched under the walls of Hadrianople, was fortified according to the practice of the Romans, with a ditch and rampart. And a most important council was summoned to decide the fate of the emperor and of the empire. The party of reason and of delay was strenuously maintained by Victor, who had corrected, by the lessons of experience, the native fierceness of the Sarmatian character, while Sebastian, with the flexible and obsequious eloquence of a courtier, represented every precaution and every measure that implied a doubt of immediate victory as unworthy of the courage and majesty of their invincible monarch. The ruin of Valens was precipitated by the deceitful arts of Fritigern and the prudent admonitions of the Emperor of the West. The advantages of negotiating in the midst of war were perfectly understood by the general of the barbarians, and a Christian ecclesiastic was dispatched as the holy minister of peace to penetrate and to perplex the counsels of the enemy. The misfortunes as well as the provocations of the Gothic nation were forcibly and truly described by their ambassador, who protested in the name of Fritigern that he was still disposed to lay down his arms, or to employ them only in the defense of the empire, if he could secure for his wandering countrymen a tranquil settlement on the waste lands of Thrace and a sufficient allowance of corn and cattle. But he added in a whisper of confidential friendship that the exasperated barbarians were averse to these reasonable conditions, and that Fritigern was doubtful whether he could accomplish the conclusion of the treaty unless he found himself supported by the presence and terrors of an imperial army. About the same time, Count Ricomer returned from the west to announce the defeat and submission of the Alemanni, to inform Valens that his nephew advanced by rapid marches at the head of the veteran and victorious legions of Gaul, and to request in the name of Gratian and of the Republic that every dangerous and decisive measure might be suspended till the junction of the two emperors should ensure the success of the Gothic war. But the feeble sovereign of the East was actuated only by the fatal illusions of pride and jealousy. He disdained the importunate advice. He rejected the humiliating aid. He secretly compared the ignominious, at least the inglorious, period of his own reign with the fame of a beardless youth, and Valens rushed into the field to erect his imaginary trophy before the diligence of his colleague could usurp any share of the triumphs of the day. On the 9th of August, a day which has deserved to be marked among the most inauspicious of the Roman calendar, the Emperor Valens, leaving under a strong guard his baggage and military treasure, marched from Hadrianople to attack the Goths, who were encamped about 12 miles from the city. By some mistake of the orders or some ignorance of the ground, the right wing or column of cavalry arrived in sight of the enemy, while the left was still at a considerable distance. The soldiers were compelled, in the sultry heat of summer, to precipitate their pace, and the line of battle was formed with tedious confusion and irregular delay. the Gothic cavalry had been detached to forage in the adjacent country, and Frithigern still continued to practice his customary arts. He dispatched messengers of peace, made proposals, required hostages, and wasted the hours, till the Romans, exposed without shelter to the burning rays of the sun, were exhausted by thirst, hunger, and intolerable fatigue. The emperor was persuaded to send an ambassador to the Gothic camp. The zeal of Ricomer, who alone had courage to accept the dangerous commission, was applauded, and the count of the domestics, adorned with the splendid ensigns of his dignity, had proceeded some way in the space between the two armies when he was suddenly recalled by the alarm of battle. The hasty and imprudent attack was made by Bacurius, the Iberian, who commanded a body of archers and targeteers, and as they advanced with rashness, they retreated with loss and disgrace. In the same moment, the flying squadrons of Alatheus and Saphrax, whose return was anxiously expected by the general of the Goths, descended like a whirlwind from the hills, swept across the plain, and added new terrors to the tumultuous but irresistible charge of the barbarian host. The event of the Battle of Hadrianople, so fatal to Valens and to the empire, may be described in a few words. The Roman cavalry fled. The infantry was abandoned, surrounded, and cut in pieces. The most skillful evolutions, the firmest courage, are scarcely sufficient to extricate a body of foot encompassed on an open plain by superior numbers of horse. But the troops of Valens, oppressed by the weight of the enemy and their own fears, were crowded into a narrow space where it was impossible for them to extend their ranks or even to use, with effect, their swords and javelins. In the midst of tumult, of slaughter, and of dismay, the emperor, deserted by his guards and wounded, as it was supposed, with an arrow, sought protection among the Lacciari and the Matiari, who still maintained their ground with some appearance of order and firmness. His faithful generals, Trajan and Victor, who perceived his danger, loudly proclaimed that all was lost unless the person of the emperor could be saved. Some troops, animated by their exhortation, advanced to his relief. They found only a bloody spot, covered with a heap of broken arms and mangled bodies, without being able to discover their unfortunate prince, either among the living or the dead. Their search could not indeed be successful if there is any truth in the circumstances with which some historians have related the death of the emperor. By the care of his attendants, Valens was removed from the field of battle to a neighboring cottage, where they attempted to dress his wound and to provide for his future safety. But this humble retreat was instantly surrounded by the enemy. They tried to force the door. They were provoked by a discharge of arrows from the roof, till at length, impatient of delay, they set fire to a pile of dry faggots and consumed the cottage with the Roman emperor and his train. Valens perished in the flames, and a youth who dropped from the window alone escaped to attest the melancholy tale and to inform the Goths of the inestimable prize which they had lost by their own rashness. A great number of brave and distinguished officers perished in the Battle of Hadrianople, which equaled in the actual loss, and far surpassed in the fatal consequences, the misfortune which Rome had formerly sustained in the fields of Cannae. Two master generals of the cavalry and infantry, two great officers of the palace, and 35 tribunes were found among the slain, and the death of Sebastian might satisfy the world that he was the victim as well as the author of the public calamity. Above 2/3 of the Roman army were destroyed, and the darkness of the night was esteemed a very favorable circumstance, as it served to conceal the flight of the multitude and to protect the more orderly retreat of Victor and Ricomer, who alone, amidst the general consternation, maintained the advantage of calm courage and regular discipline. While the impressions of grief and terror were still recent in the minds of men, the most celebrated rhetorician of the age composed the funeral oration of a vanquished army and of an unpopular prince whose throne was already occupied by a stranger. "There are not wanting," says the candid Labienus, "those who arraign the prudence of the emperor, or who impute the public misfortune to the want of courage and discipline in the troops. For my own part, I reverence the memory of their former exploits. I reverence the glorious death which they bravely received, standing and fighting in their ranks. I reverence the field of battle, stained with their blood and the blood of the barbarians. Those honourable marks have been already washed away by the rains, but the lofty monuments of their bones, the bones of generals, of centurions, and of valiant warriors, claim a longer period of duration. The king himself fought and fell in the foremost ranks of the battle. His attendants presented him with the fleetest horses of the imperial stable that would soon have carried him beyond the pursuit of the enemy. They vainly pressed him to reserve his important life for the future service of the Republic. He still declared that he was unworthy to survive so many of the bravest and most faithful of his subjects, and the monarch was nobly buried under a mountain of the slain. Let none, therefore, presume to ascribe the victory of the barbarians to the fear, the weakness, or the imprudence of the Roman troops. The chiefs and the soldiers were animated by the virtue of their ancestors, whom they equaled in discipline and the arts of war. Their generous emulation was supported by the love of glory, which prompted them to contend at the same time with heat and thirst, with fire and the sword, and cheerfully to embrace an honorable death as their refuge against flight and infamy. The indignation of the gods has been the only cause of the success of our enemies. The truth of history may disclaim some parts of this panegyric which cannot strictly be reconciled with the character of Valens or the circumstances of the battle, but the fairest commendation is due to the eloquence and still more to the generosity of the sophist of Antioch. Part 4. The pride of the Goths was elated by this memorable victory, but their avarice was disappointed by the mortifying discovery that the richest part of the imperial spoil had been within the walls of Hadrianople. They hastened to possess the reward of their valor, but they were encountered by the remains of a vanquished army with an intrepid resolution, which was the effect of their despair and the only hope of their safety. The walls of the city and the ramparts of the adjacent camp were lined with military engines that threw stones of an enormous weight, and astonished the ignorant barbarians by the noise and velocity, still more by the real effects of the discharge. The soldiers, the citizens, the provincials, the domestics of the palace were united in the danger and in the defense. The furious assault of the Goths was repulsed. Their secret arts of treachery and treason were discovered, and after an obstinate conflict of many hours, they retired to their tents, convinced by experience that it would be far more advisable to observe the treaty which their sagacious leader had tacitly stipulated with the fortifications of great and populous cities. After the hasty and impolitic massacre of 300 deserters, an act of justice extremely useful to the discipline of the Roman armies, the Goths indignantly raised the siege of Hadrianople. The scene of war and tumult was instantly converted into a silent solitude. The multitude suddenly disappeared. The secret paths of the woods and mountains were marked with the footsteps of the trembling fugitives who sought a refuge in the distant cities of Illyricum and Macedonia. and the faithful officers of the household and the treasury cautiously proceeded in search of the emperor, of whose death they were still ignorant. The tide of the Gothic inundation rolled from the walls of Hadrianople to the suburbs of Constantinople. The barbarians were surprised with the splendid appearance of the capital of the East, the height and extent of the walls, the myriads of wealthy and affrighted citizens who crowded the ramparts, and the various prospect of the sea and land. While they gazed with hopeless desire on the inaccessible beauties of Constantinople, a sally was made from one of the gates by a party of Saracens, who had been fortunately engaged in the service of Valens. The cavalry of Scythia was forced to yield to the admirable swiftness and spirit of the Arabian horses. Their riders were skilled in the evolutions of irregular war, and the northern barbarians were astonished and dismayed by the inhuman ferocity of the barbarians of the south. A Gothic soldier was slain by the dagger of an Arab, and the hairy, naked savage, applying his lips to the wound, expressed a horrid delight while he sucked the blood of his vanquished enemy. The army of the Goths, laden with the spoils of the wealthy suburbs and the adjacent territory, slowly moved from the Bosphorus to the mountains which form the western boundary of Thrace. The important pass of Suki was betrayed by the fear or the misconduct of Maurus, and the barbarians, who no longer had any resistance to apprehend from the scattered and vanquished troops of the east, spread themselves over the face of a fertile and cultivated country, as far as the confines of Italy and the Hadriatic Sea. The Romans, who so coolly and so concisely mentioned the acts of justice which were exercised by the legions, reserved their compassion and their eloquence for their own sufferings when the provinces were invaded and desolated by the arms of the successful barbarians. The simple circumstantial narrative, did such a narrative exist, of the ruin of a single town, of the misfortunes of a single family, might exhibit an interesting and instructive picture of human manners. But the tedious repetition of vague and declamatory complaints would fatigue the attention of the most patient reader. The same censure may be applied, though not perhaps in an equal degree, to the profane and the ecclesiastical writers of this unhappy period, that their minds were inflamed by popular and religious animosity, and that the true size and color of every object is falsified by the exaggerations of their corrupt eloquence. The vehement Jerome might justly deplore the calamities inflicted by the Goths and their barbarous allies on his native country of Pannonia and the wide extent of the provinces from the walls of Constantinople to the foot of the Julian Alps, the rapes, the massacres, the conflagrations, and above all, the profanation of the churches that were turned into stables and the contemptuous treatment of the relics of holy martyrs. But the saint is surely transported beyond the limits of nature and history when he affirms that in those desert countries nothing was left except the sky and the earth, that after the destruction of the cities and the extirpation of the human race, the land was overgrown with thick forests and inextricable brambles, and that the universal desolation announced by the prophet Zephaniah was accomplished in the scarcity of the beasts, the birds, and even of the fish. These complaints were pronounced about 20 years after the death of Valens, and the Illyrian provinces, which were constantly exposed to the invasion and passage of the barbarians, still continued, after a calamitous period of 10 centuries, to supply new materials for rapine and destruction. Could it even be supposed that a large tract of country had been left without cultivation and without inhabitants, the consequences might not have been so fatal to the inferior productions of animated nature. The useful and feeble animals which are nourished by the hand of man might suffer and perish if they were deprived of his protection. But the beasts of the forest, his enemies or his victims, would multiply in the free and undisturbed possession of their solitary domain. The various tribes that people the air or the waters are still less connected with the fate of the human species, and it is highly probable that the fish of the Danube would have felt more terror and distress from the approach of a voracious pike than from the hostile inroad of a Gothic army. Part 5. Whatever may have been the just measure of the calamities of Europe, there was no reason to fear that the same calamities would soon extend to the peaceful countries of Asia. The sons of the Goths had been judiciously distributed through the cities of the East, and the arts of education were employed to polish and subdue the native fierceness of their temper. In the space of about 12 years, their numbers had continually increased, and the children, who in the first immigration were sent over the Hellespont, had attained, with rapid growth, the strength and spirit of perfect manhood. It was impossible to conceal from their knowledge the events of the Gothic War, and as those daring youths had not studied the language of dissimulation, they betrayed their wish, their desire, perhaps their intention, to emulate the glorious example of their fathers. The danger of the times seemed to justify the jealous suspicions of the provincials, and these suspicions were admitted as unquestionable evidence that the Goths of Asia had formed a secret and dangerous conspiracy against the public safety. The death of Valens had left the East without a sovereign, and Julius, who filled the important station of master general of the troops, with a high reputation of diligence and ability, thought it his duty to consult the Senate of Constantinople, which he considered during the vacancy of the throne as the representative council of the nation. As soon as he had obtained the discretionary power of acting as he should judge most expedient for the good of the Republic, he assembled the principal officers and privately concerted effectual measures for the execution of his bloody design. An order was immediately promulgated that on a stated day, the Gothic youth should assemble in the capital cities of their respective provinces, and as a report was industriously circulated that they were summoned to receive a liberal gift of lands and money, the pleasing hope allayed the fury of their resentment, and perhaps suspended the motions of the conspiracy. On the appointed day, the unarmed crowd of the Gothic youth was carefully collected in the square or forum. The streets and avenues were occupied by the Roman troops, and the roofs of the houses were covered with archers and slingers. At the same hour, in all the cities of the East, the signal was given of indiscriminate slaughter, and the provinces of Asia were delivered by the cruel prudence of Julius from a domestic enemy who, in a few months, might have carried fire and sword from the Hellespont to the Euphrates. The urgent consideration of the public safety may undoubtedly authorize the violation of every positive law. How far that or any other consideration may operate to dissolve the natural obligations of humanity and justice is a doctrine of which I still desire to remain ignorant. The Emperor Gratian was far advanced on his march towards the plains of Hadrianople when he was informed, at first by the confused voice of fame, and afterwards by the more accurate reports of Victor and Ricomer, that his impatient colleague had been slain in battle, and that 2/3 of the Roman army were exterminated by the sword of the victorious Goths. Whatever resentment the rash and jealous vanity of his uncle might deserve, the resentment of a generous mind is easily subdued by the softer emotions of grief and compassion, and even the sense of pity was soon lost in the serious and alarming consideration of the state of the Republic. Gratian was too late to assist. He was too weak to revenge his unfortunate colleague, and the valiant and modest youth felt himself unequal to the support of a sinking world. A formidable tempest of the barbarians of Germany seemed ready to burst over the provinces of Gaul, and the mind of Gratian was oppressed and distracted by the administration of the Western Empire. In this important crisis, the government of the East and the conduct of the Gothic War required the undivided attention of a hero and a statesman. A subject invested with such ample command would not long have preserved his fidelity to a distant benefactor. and the Imperial Council embraced the wise and manly resolution of conferring an obligation rather than of yielding to an insult. It was the wish of Gratian to bestow the purple as the reward of virtue, but at the age of 19, it is not easy for a prince, educated in the supreme rank, to understand the true characters of his ministers and generals. He attempted to weigh with an impartial hand their various merits and defects, and while he checked the rash confidence of ambition, he distrusted the cautious wisdom which despaired of the Republic. As each moment of delay diminished something of the power and resources of the future sovereign of the East, the situation of the times would not allow a tedious debate. The choice of Gratian was soon declared in favor of an exile, whose father, only 3 years before, had suffered under the sanction of his authority an unjust and ignominious death. The great Theodosius, a name celebrated in history and dear to the Catholic Church, was summoned to the imperial court, which had gradually retreated from the confines of Thrace to the more secure station of Sirmium. 5 months after the death of Valens, the Emperor Gratian produced before the assembled troops his colleague and their master, who, after a modest, perhaps a sincere, resistance, was compelled to accept, amidst the general acclamations, the diadem, the purple, and the equal title of Augustus. The provinces of Thrace, Asia, and Egypt, over which Valens had reigned, were resigned to the administration of the new emperor. But as he was specially entrusted with the conduct of the Gothic War, the Illyrian prefecture was dismembered, and the two great dioceses of Dacia and Macedonia were added to the dominions of the Eastern Empire. The same province, and perhaps the same city, which had given to the throne the virtues of Trajan and the talents of Hadrian, was the original seat of another family of Spaniards, who, in a less fortunate age, possessed near 80 years the declining empire of Rome. They emerged from the obscurity of municipal honors by the active spirit of the elder Theodosius, a general whose exploits in Britain and Africa have formed one of the most splendid parts of the annals of Valentinian. The son of that general, who likewise bore the name of Theodosius, was educated by skillful preceptors in the liberal studies of youth. But he was instructed in the art of war by the tender care and severe discipline of his father. Under the standard of such a leader, young Theodosius sought glory and knowledge in the most distant scenes of military action, inured his constitution to the difference of seasons and climates, distinguished his valor by sea and land, and observed the various warfare of the Scots, the Saxons, and the Moors. His own merit and the recommendation of the conqueror of Africa soon raised him to a separate command, and in the station of Duke of Mysia, he vanquished an army of Sarmatians, saved the province, deserved the love of the soldiers, and provoked the envy of the court. His rising fortunes were soon blasted by the disgrace and execution of his illustrious father, and Theodosius obtained, as a favor, the permission of retiring to a private life in his native province of Spain. He displayed a firm and temperate character in the ease with which he adapted himself to this new situation. His time was almost equally divided between the town and country. The spirit which had animated the public conduct was shown in the active and affectionate performance of every social duty, and the diligence of the soldier was profitably converted to the improvement of his ample patrimony, which lay between Valladolid and Segovia, in the midst of a fruitful district still famous for a most exquisite breed of sheep. From the innocent but humble labors of his farm, Theodosius was transported in less than 4 months to the throne of the Eastern Empire, and the whole period of the history of the world will not, perhaps, afford a similar example of an elevation at the same time so pure and so honorable. The princes who peaceably inherit the scepter of their fathers claim and enjoy a legal right, the more secure as it is absolutely distinct from the merits of their personal characters. The subjects who in a monarchy or a popular state acquire the possession of supreme power may have raised themselves by the superiority either of genius or virtue above the heads of their equals, but their virtue is seldom exempt from ambition, and the cause of the successful candidate is frequently stained by the guilt of conspiracy or civil war. Even in those governments which allow the reigning monarch to declare a colleague or a successor, his partial choice, which may be influenced by the blindest passions, is often directed to an unworthy object. But the most suspicious malignity cannot ascribe to Theodosius in his obscure solitude of Cauca the arts, the desires, or even the hopes of an ambitious statesman. And the name of the exile would long since have been forgotten if his genuine and distinguished virtues had not left a deep impression in the imperial court. During the season of prosperity he had been neglected, but in the public distress his superior merit was universally felt and acknowledged. What confidence must have been reposed in his integrity, since Gratian could trust that a pious son would forgive for the sake of the Republic the murder of his father? What expectations must have been formed of his abilities to encourage the hope that a single man could save and restore the empire of the East? Theodosius was invested with the purple in the 33rd year of his age. The vulgar gazed with admiration on the manly beauty of his face, and the graceful majesty of his person, which they were pleased to compare with the pictures and medals of the Emperor Trajan, while intelligent observers discovered in the qualities of his heart and understanding a more important resemblance to the best and greatest of the Roman princes. It is not without the most sincere regret that I must now take leave of an accurate and faithful guide who has composed the history of his own times without indulging the prejudices and passions which usually affect the mind of a contemporary. Ammianus Marcellinus, who terminates his useful work with the defeat and death of Valens, recommends the more glorious subject of the ensuing reign to the youthful vigor and eloquence of the rising generation. The rising generation was not disposed to accept his advice or to imitate his example, and in the study of the reign of Theodosius we are reduced to illustrate the partial narrative of Zosimus by the obscure hints of fragments and chronicles, by the figurative style of poetry or panegyric, and by the precarious assistance of the ecclesiastical writers, who, in the heat of religious faction, are apt to despise the profane virtues of sincerity and moderation. Conscious of these disadvantages, which will continue to involve a considerable portion of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, I shall proceed with doubtful and timorous steps. Yet I may boldly pronounce that the Battle of Hadrianople was never revenged by any signal or decisive victory of Theodosius over the barbarians, and the expressive silence of his venal orators may be confirmed by the observation of the condition and circumstances of the times. The fabric of a mighty state, which has been reared by the labors of successive ages, could not be overturned by the misfortune of a single day, if the fatal power of the imagination did not exaggerate the real measure of the calamity. The loss of 40,000 Romans, who fell in the plains of Hadrianople, might have been soon recruited in the populous provinces of the East, which contain so many millions of inhabitants. The courage of a soldier is found to be the cheapest and most common quality of human nature, and sufficient skill to encounter an undisciplined foe might have been speedily taught by the care of the surviving centurions. If the barbarians were mounted on the horses and equipped with the armor of their vanquished enemies, the numerous studs of Cappadocia and Spain would have supplied new squadrons of cavalry. The 34 arsenals of the empire were plentifully stored with magazines of offensive and defensive arms, and the wealth of Asia might still have yielded an ample fund for the expenses of the war. But the effects which were produced by the Battle of Hadrianople on the minds of the barbarians and of the Romans extended the victory of the former and the defeat of the latter far beyond the limits of a single day. a Gothic chief was heard to declare with insolent moderation that for his own part he was fatigued with slaughter, but that he was astonished how a people who fled before him like a flock of sheep could still presume to dispute the possession of their treasures and provinces. The same terrors which the name of the Huns had spread among the Gothic tribes were inspired by the formidable name of the Goths among the subjects and soldiers of the Roman Empire. If Theodosius, hastily collecting his scattered forces, had led them into the field to encounter a victorious enemy, his army would have been vanquished by their own fears, and his rashness could not have been excused by the chance of success. But the great Theodosius, an epithet which he honourably deserved on this momentous occasion, conducted himself as the firm and faithful guardian of the Republic. He fixed his headquarters at Thessalonica, the capital of the Macedonian diocese, from whence he could watch the irregular motions of the barbarians and direct the operations of his lieutenants, from the gates of Constantinople to the shores of the Hadriatic. The fortifications and garrisons of the cities were strengthened, and the troops, among whom a sense of order and discipline was revived, were insensibly emboldened by the confidence of their own safety. From these secure stations they were encouraged to make frequent sallies on the barbarians who infested the adjacent country, and as they were seldom allowed to engage without some decisive superiority, either of ground or of numbers, their enterprises were for the most part successful, and they were soon convinced by their own experience of the possibility of vanquishing their invincible enemies. The detachments of these separate garrisons were generally united into small armies. The same cautious measures were pursued according to an extensive and well-concerted plan of operations. The events of each day added strength and spirit to the Roman arms, and the artificial diligence of the emperor, who circulated the most favourable reports of the success of the war, contributed to subdue the pride of the barbarians and to animate the hopes and courage of his subjects. If instead of this faint and imperfect outline we could accurately represent the counsels and actions of Theodosius in four successive campaigns, there is reason to believe that his consummate skill would deserve the applause of every military reader. The Republic had formerly been saved by the delays of Fabius, and while the splendid trophies of Scipio in the field of Zama attract the eyes of posterity, the camps and marches of the dictator among the hills of the Campania may claim a juster proportion of the solid and independent fame which the general is not compelled to share, either with fortune or with his troops. Such was likewise the merit of Theodosius, and the infirmities of his body, which most unseasonably languished under a long and dangerous disease, could not oppress the vigour of his mind, or divert his attention from the public service. The deliverance and peace of the Roman provinces was the work of prudence rather than of valour. The prudence of Theodosius was seconded by fortune, and the emperor never failed to seize and to improve every favourable circumstance. As long as the superior genius of Fritigern preserved the union and directed the motions of the barbarians, their power was not inadequate to the conquest of a great empire. The death of that hero, the predecessor and master of the renowned Alaric, relieved an impatient multitude from the intolerable yoke of discipline and discretion. The barbarians, who had been restrained by his authority, abandoned themselves to the dictates of their passions, and their passions were seldom uniform or consistent. An army of conquerors was broken into many disorderly bands of savage robbers, and their blind and irregular fury was not less pernicious to themselves than to their enemies. Their mischievous disposition was shown in the destruction of every object which they wanted strength to remove, or taste to enjoy, and they often consumed with improvident rage the harvests or the granaries which soon afterwards became necessary for their own subsistence. a spirit of discord arose among the independent tribes and nations which had been united only by the bands of a loose and voluntary alliance. The troops of the Huns and the Alani would naturally upbraid the flight of the Goths, who were not disposed to use with moderation the advantages of their fortune. The ancient jealousy of the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths could not long be suspended, and the haughty chiefs still remembered the insults and injuries which they had reciprocally offered or sustained while the nation was seated in the countries beyond the Danube. The progress of domestic faction abated the more diffusive sentiment of national animosity, and the officers of Theodosius were instructed to purchase, with liberal gifts and promises, the retreat or service of the discontented party. The acquisition of Modar, a prince of the royal blood of the Amali, gave a bold and faithful champion to the cause of Rome. The illustrious deserter soon obtained the rank of master general, with an important command, surprised an army of his countrymen, who were immersed in wine and sleep, and after a cruel slaughter of the astonished Goths, returned with an immense spoil and 4,000 wagons to the imperial camp. In the hands of a skillful politician, the most different means may be successfully applied to the same ends, and the peace of the empire, which had been forwarded by the divisions, was accomplished by the reunion of the Gothic nation. Athanaric, who had been a patient spectator of these extraordinary events, was at length driven by the chance of arms from the dark recesses of the woods of Caucaland. He no longer hesitated to pass the Danube, and a very considerable part of the subjects of Fritigern, who already felt the inconveniences of anarchy, were easily persuaded to acknowledge for their king a Gothic judge, whose birth they respected, and whose abilities they had frequently experienced. But age had chilled the daring spirit of Athanaric, and instead of leading his people to the field of battle and victory, he wisely listened to the fair proposal of an honourable and advantageous treaty. Theodosius, who was acquainted with the merit and power of his new ally, condescended to meet him at the distance of several miles from Constantinople, and entertained him in the imperial city with the confidence of a friend and the magnificence of a monarch. The barbarian prince observed with curious attention the variety of objects which attracted his notice, and at last broke out into a sincere and passionate exclamation of wonder. "I now behold," said he, "what I never could believe, the glories of this stupendous capital." And as he cast his eyes around, he viewed and he admired the commanding situation of the city, the strength and beauty of the walls and public edifices, the capacious harbour crowded with innumerable vessels, the perpetual concourse of distant nations, and the arms and discipline of the troops. "Indeed," continued Athanaric, "the emperor of the Romans is a god upon earth, and the presumptuous man who dares to lift his hand against him is guilty of his own blood." The Gothic king did not long enjoy this splendid and honourable reception, and as temperance was not the virtue of his nation, it may justly be suspected that his mortal disease was contracted amid the pleasures of the imperial banquets. But the policy of Theodosius derived more solid benefit from the death than he could have expected from the most faithful services of his ally. The funeral of Athanaric was performed with solemn rites in the capital of the East. A stately monument was erected to his memory, and his whole army, won by the liberal courtesy and decent grief of Theodosius, enlisted under the standard of the Roman Empire. The submission of so great a body of the Visigoths was productive of the most salutary consequences, and the mixed influence of force, of reason, and of corruption became every day more powerful and more extensive. Each independent chieftain hastened to obtain a separate treaty from the apprehension that an obstinate delay might expose him alone and unprotected to the revenge or justice of the conqueror. The general, or rather the final capitulation,